The Sunstone Theological Society presents this live recording from the 1988 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 17th through the 20th, 1988. We take you to the University Park Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
Symposium, which is why do some perceive the church to be a cult, inside and outside perceptions versus reality. You can't hear. Is this on? What about this?
Oh.
No. Okay, this is one session of the symposium which is called Why Do Some Perceive the Church to Be a Cult? Inside and Outside Perceptions versus Reality. Lou Chandler is going to be giving the paper, and she currently manages an in-house advertising agency for SMS, which is an international computer software corporation based in Pennsylvania. She handles public relations for a three-state region of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Previously, she owned and operated Chandler Advertising and Public Relations, managed the Drought Center, and handled public information for the state of Utah during the drought crisis of 77. She's listed in Who's Who of American Women and in Outstanding Young Women of America. She has a degree in communications and a degree in theater from Southern Utah State University. She also attended Dixie College and BYU and has done graduate work at the University of Utah. She lives with her husband and two children in Wayne, Pennsylvania. The commentators will be Larry Cannon and Helen Cannon, and Larry will be giving the paper. He's a professor in mathematics from Utah State University, and Helen Cannon teaches English, and she's a freelance writer. They live in Logan, Utah. This session of the symposium is going to be recorded, and tapes will be available at the registration desk afterwards. Thank you.
About 3 years ago, I was invited to attend a luncheon group within my company. It was a bring-your-own-lunch affair once a week that was initiated by a small group of employees who referred to it as the Christian Fellowship Luncheon. I was told it was non-denominational, that it would be a nice break in the week, so I decided to attend it with the friend who had invited me. The first order of business was that day was to go through the calendar and identify who was going to lead what discussions over the next few weeks. The head of the group addressed a fellow sitting next to me, saying, "Bob, weren't you going to present something about the Mormons?" "Yes," Bob answered, "I suppose I could do that next week." Well, I was cautiously elated at the possibility that perhaps beside me sat another Mormon in this, that perhaps I was not the only Mormon in this international corporation after all. And I said, hopefully, "Are you a Mormon?" And he replied, "Oh, no, we've just been doing a little study of cults. And I'm doing something on the Mormons." "Oh," I responded, utterly disappointed and insulted, trying very hard not to appear utterly disappointed and insulted. "Well," I said, "I'll surely be interested to hear that, because you see, I'm a Mormon and it's not a cult." Well, instantly Bob's face turned beet red, which clashed terribly with his carrot red hair, and the leader of the group awkwardly tried to change the subject. Well, needless to say, the Mormon cult presentation never took place, at least not while I was there. Having grown up in Utah, this was my first poignant encounter with the idea that some people consider our church to be a cult. About that same time, I was called to be a regional public communications director for the church. And as such, I've been confronted with that idea on a number of occasions. And I've learned that Mormonism being considered a cult isn't particularly an isolated idea. In fact, practically every book on the subject of cults references Mormons to a greater or lesser degree. Furthermore, interest in the subject is very high right now, at least it is in Pennsylvania. At the library, I reported to the librarian that not one of the books that I needed on cults was available on the shelf, to which she responded, "Oh, you're researching cults. Well, we can't keep those books in the library. People just check them out and keep them. It's a hot topic, you know." Well, fortunately for me, I had a trip to Utah planned where, interestingly enough, the subject of cults is not so hot a topic, and I was able to find most of the books that I needed. This is a significant issue for the church, for the simple reason that people don't like cults. People avoid cults. People actually fear cults. Therefore, any perception that the church is a cult carries with it the high potential of thwarting missionary work, which is no small concern, because the first of the church's three stated mission of the church is to proclaim the gospel. Now let's explore missionary effort from a little further, from a little different perspective. President Kimball said, "When we have used our qualified people to help the apostles to open these new fields of labor, when we have used the satellite and all of the media, the papers, magazines, television, radio, all in their greatest power, then and not until then shall we approach the insistence of our Lord and Master to go into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature." The qualified people who understand how to use the media are people in the fields of advertising and public relations. In these fields, the fundamentals of media relations, somewhat overly simplified, are as follows. We identify and analyze what the audience currently thinks about a product or issue, determine what we want the audience to think about the product or issue, assess what messages and strategies will change the audience's thinking in our favor, and execute strategies with creative solutions. Now, given that background, as one might imagine, reality is truly irrelevant in this exercise. What really matters is perception. And having gone through this exercise repeatedly, I can say that the cult issue is quite high on the list of problematic perceptions. In my region, it's in the top three. So, what is a cult? The answer is a bit nebulous, depending on the expert or layperson that you happen to consult. But some of the more radical writers on the subject categorize practically all spiritual experience as pertaining to cults. Other more conservative writers define cults in more specific terms. Here's a summation of the more rational and agreed-upon descriptors of cults synthesized from various books on the subject. Just put up and over. First, they talk about the existence of a charismatic founder or leader to whom Mormons express total to which members of the whatever cult they're talking about express total allegiance. This leader proclaims doctrines or truths and determines rules for daily life that cannot be questioned. The leader may be called a messiah or prophet. Individual thought is discouraged. The groups are anti-intellectual. Knowledge is redefined as ideas dispensed by the group or its leader. A member is expected to surrender his intellect to unquestioned doctrine. Former members, by the way, report having gradually become incapable of making even the simplest decisions on their own. Many cults regulate much or all of the followers' personal life, including diet, use of tobacco, liquor, drugs, sexual activity, the use of birth control, the choice of marriage partners, and whether, when, and how to bear children. Cults manipulate members through the use of guilt, and any expressions of doubt or dissension are answered with helpings of guilt. By the way, a professor of religion at Temple University, Rabbi Salzman Schlechter, maintains that any group which equates doubt with guilt is a cult. Cult members are often isolated from the outside world. They are told that the outside world is evil and satanic and that salvation can come only by remaining in the group. In that connection, he or she is frequently given a new name and or different or unique clothes and hairstyles. The cult discourages or forbids the follower to have ties with past psychological support systems like families and friends, therapy, etc. The follower is made to believe that all problems can only be solved by the group. The cult claims to possess the one and only truth. They typically believe in an impersonal God, undifferentiated from the universe or creation. Many cults are anti-women, anti-child, and anti-family. The rationale for their being anti-family is that the aim for all members is to be very childlike and submissive, so the responsibility of rearing real children are inconsistent. And family bonds must be subordinated to loyalty to the cult, which references itself as a higher family. Deceptive recruitment techniques are typical. The potential follower may not be told what he is getting into and what will be required of him or her. Cult members may live in poverty while leaders live in luxury. The followers often work full-time for the group with long hours and little or no pay. Some who work outside the group turn their salaries over to the cult. Many have the philosophy that the ends justify the means. They often feel that they are not subject to civil laws. There is frequently an aura of violence or potential violence. Cults are shrouded in secrecy and mystery. They keep new members in the dark, promising more knowledge as they become involved. Some leaders are rarely, if ever, seen. Most are small and local and short-lived. Because of the need for a charismatic leader, they have a real problem with succession. A few other extraneous but interesting statements on cults include that some members say things like they feel like they've come home. They are opposed to elaborate ceremony. Science is often joined with traditional religious ideas to give it a more modern identity. Cult members are frequently searching for a spiritual, mystical, or ecstatic experience, whether personally or vicariously through the leader. It should be noted that few, if any, cults measure up to each and every one of these descriptors. And I found it an interesting exercise to explore the extent to which the church measures up. In absence of actual statistical data relative to these descriptors, I made some educated guesses on how a potential investigator might perceive the church relative to these things. And I'll just reveal this. With three being most applicable and zero being not applicable at all, I've identified my assessment of outside perceptions on this chart. I'm confident that many would come up with somewhat different ratings resulting from different experiences in the church, but the important thing to be remembered is that we're talking about perceptions, not reality, where public relations is concerned. After finishing this exercise, it occurred to me that if Christ were on the earth today, he would surely be considered a cult leader, even though many of these descriptors would not apply to him, just as many do not apply to the church. Further, it's an interesting exercise to measure how the Baptists and Catholics measure up to these descriptors. And though many of the answers would come out differently, the total scores may come out very much the same. Nevertheless, those other mainstream religions are not considered cults in the literature. We are. Part of it could be that they've stood a longer test of time than we have, but I'm convinced there's a little bit more to it than that. Beyond what the so-called experts think, it's even more important to take note of what the non-expert public thinks of cults. The church commissioned a Gallup poll in 1969, and among other things, learned that the public at large, primarily considers cult members to be fanatical followers of a charismatic leader where mindless or blind obedience is expected. Other cult characteristics identified in this poll include such things as doctrines that are not based on the Bible or not solely based on the Bible, power over members' money, and not being Christian in nature. At the time of that poll, approximately 15% of the population considered the Mormon Church to be a cult. And depending on your perspective, that may not be too troublesome of a figure, especially if it's on the decline. But it should also be noted that this poll was taken very shortly after the Jonestown tragedy. Our church probably appeared pretty down to earth in contrast to Jim Jones' group. And it preceded most of the current literature in which the church is described as a cult. In any event, we expect that subsequent research will show the percentages to be on the increase. And in areas where the church is particularly obscure, as it is in Pennsylvania, we can logically expect the percentage to be greater. I wanted to further learn how those lay perceptions related to my region, so I conducted my own little informal survey. And although the sample was too small to be considered valid, the results were nonetheless enlightening, and for the most part agreed with the top characteristics of cults identified by the Gallup poll. In my survey, I asked, what do you think are the primary characteristics of cults? Would you want to be associated with a cult? If so, why? And if not, and the answer was always in the negative, what characteristics of cults would you find most troublesome? The response to these questions, almost without exception, drew words like brainwashing and mind control. The fundamental conclusion I must draw is that people are afraid of cults primarily because they're afraid of having someone or something controlling them or restricting their freedoms. The responses to these questions, I skipped a little bit. Comparing these points with the characteristics of cults from the experts, I find that numbers 1 through 4 apply to the issues of control most directly. Further, I note that those four characteristics are also the ones that apply most to the church from the standpoint of outside perceptions. The logical conclusion is that people who perceive the church to be a cult probably assume that the church engages in mind control and in restricting members' freedoms. Now, I find that to be a fascinating perception when you contrast that with Mormonism's rather unique doctrines of the plan of salvation and the very pivotal role of free agency as set forth by Christ in the pre-existence. When you think about it, it's incredibly ironic. There was, of course, a contrasting plan presented by another of the Father's children, whose name was Lucifer, a plan devoid of free agency. How important free agency must have been for God to suffer the loss of a third of his children over the issue. President David O. McKay wrote, "Next to the bestowal of life itself, the right to direct that life is God's greatest gift to man. Freedom of choice is more to be treasured than any possession earth can give." Marion D. Hanks said, "God so loved that he would not shield us from the perils of freedom, from the right and responsibility to choose. So deep is his love and so precious that principle that he who was conscious of the consequences required that we choose." Spencer W. Kimball said, "I would not, even if I could, force your thinking. For free agency is the basic law of God, and each one must assume the responsibility for his own response." Henry D. Moyle suggested, "Examine any movement that may be brought into our midst, and if it attempts to deprive us in the slightest respect of our free agency, we should avoid it as we would avoid immorality or any other thing that is vicious." I'm going to turn this little thing off. Of course, free agency is pivotal. The purpose of our earthly experience, in addition to gaining a body, is to be tried and tested, and to gain experience to learn and grow. We would not inhibit the growth of our children by making all their decisions for them, and neither would God. If we are to become like him, we must gain decision-making skill through the choices we make. Neil Maxwell described us as being enclosed in a mortal cocoon or classroom. With an understanding of God's plan of salvation, we know that the striving, the suffering, the tutoring, and the enduring experiences of life all play their part in an intelligible process of helping us, if we will, to become as the Savior beckoningly invited us, even as I am. He further emphasizes, "Truly, of all the errors that mortals could make, God's plan of salvation is the wrong thing to be wrong about. No error could be more enormous, more everlasting in its consequences." Clearly, the doctrines of the church are 180 degrees away from the pursuit of mind control. Nevertheless, here we are with this perception problem. And unless we decided to only go after that segment of the population with character disorders, people who prefer to avoid the responsibilities associated with freedom, we must recognize that this perception of Mormon mind control is a worthy adversary to missionary efforts. Just the other day, I had lunch with a colleague who, as an advertising account executive, services a Utah ski resort account. He remarked how impressed he was with Temple Square when he was here visiting, and how impressed he was with the family orientation of the church. "But wow," he said, "all that control stuff is downright scary." And his remark is not out of context, or out of character, rather, with the comments of other colleagues, which reflect the same perception of control. Interestingly enough, in spite of doctrinal evidence to the contrary, this perception of the church is not restricted to those outside the church. There are those inside the church as well, who, though they are active in every sense of the word, feel that their free agency is challenged by others in the church. If we assume that this cult issue is indeed an inhibitor to the number one mission of the church, that being to proclaim the gospel, and if we assume that these perceptions of overt control, both internally and externally, are even partly valid, then we must further be willing to explore the possibility that something in the church, that being the organization and the practices of its people, is a bit out of balance with the gospel relative to our doctrines of free agency. Assuming, of course, that we consider the church a separate entity from the gospel. So, let's speculate what some of the major factors might be that could contribute to internal and external perceptions that the church is control-oriented. Here are a few considerations. One, issues pertaining to priesthood leadership, control-oriented rhetoric, the power and activities of the correlation department, and judgmental, guilt-imposing tendencies of the saints. Now let's take these four considerations and dissect them to reveal possibilities for improving this perception problem. With the recognition that any strategy to correct the perception problem would require far more than mere window dressings from church public relations directors like me. First, a caveat. We, of course, must realize that in any organization there are and must be more considerations for decision-making than concern over what people think or perceive. Less, in my view, interest in our public image needs to rise to a much higher priority in the church if we are really serious about the top item on our mission statement. Priesthood leadership. During the 70s, the auxiliaries of the church were reorganized under the arm of priesthood leadership. That included the Relief Society, which previously maintained its own budget, magazine, and operated quite autonomously. This change could easily be interpreted as a rather dramatic tightening of control over women. But beyond that, there's really not so much inherently wrong with the concept of priesthood leadership as there is with some of the applications of it. First of all, we need to stop referring to the men of the church as the priesthood. People are not the priesthood. And when that rhetoric is coupled with the concept of priesthood leadership, it may be perceived by those outside as little more than a power-hungry old boys network. Further, there are those priesthood leaders who see the concept of priesthood leadership as a license to usurp the very important concept of individual stewardship. And unfortunately, if there is publicity up for grabs, it's usually that kind of priesthood leader that gets it. The issue of rhetoric, we're moving on to rhetoric now. The issue of rhetoric is very much at the heart of the matter, and without really knowing it, our rhetoric often sounds cult-like. To begin with, since one of the most common characteristics of cults, according to the literature, is the existence of an authoritarian leader, the rhetoric that surrounds our prophet is particularly important. Certainly, it's not appropriate from a religious standpoint or from a public relations standpoint to be defensive or apologetic in any way about the existence of the prophet or in the way we revere the prophet. But if we are always saying, follow the prophet, without any reference to our individual right and obligation to study it out in our own minds and gain our own testimonies of what is said and how it should apply in our individual lives, then in essence, we are setting up the prophet as a dictator in the minds of the public. And we are omitting from public expression the precious principle of free agency, our differentiator. Free agency is our differentiator that sets us apart from the cults of the world. The exercise of free agency in discerning the truth and relevance of what our leaders say is certainly not unheard of in our faith. In Thessalonians, we are exhorted to prove or test all things. J. Reuben Clark was quoted as saying, "It takes a revelation to know a revelation." And along with these thoughts, I should venture my own opinion that not every word that proceeds forth from the mouth of a prophet necessarily comes from a divine source. Consider Paul's message to the Corinthians to the effect that women should not be allowed to speak publicly in church. Or consider the rather obvious exceptions to other prophetic statements. For instance, when the prophet said that all young men should go on missions, he surely didn't mean to include the mentally disturbed, etc. How then should we follow the prophet? And how should that be reflected in our rhetoric? In my opinion, we should follow the prophet in a revelatory way, using individual thought and prayer to discern the truth of the message and how we should apply it in our individual lives. Brigham Young declared, "The spirit of revelation must be in each and every individual to know the plan of salvation and keep the path that leads to God." Richard G. Scott said, "I'm conditioned to receive and interpret divine aid to mark my path with clarity. No friend, bishop, stake president, or general authority can do this for me. It is my divine right to do it for myself." This is the kind of rhetoric that will help differentiate us from the cults of the world. As an added benefit, it may help increase the overall spirituality of the church if we are exhorted to do a little bit less resting on an easy do-as-you're-told mentality and instead do a little more flexing of spiritual muscles as we struggle to get answers for ourselves. One further note about free agency. Statements about the importance of free agency are not easy to find within official church literature. Those that were quoted at the beginning of this paper were mostly buried within articles about obedience to rather black and white commandments. Now, that's not an inappropriate place to talk about free agency. It's certainly true that sin results in the loss of certain freedoms in one way or another. But I was surprised that I didn't find it in a broader context. Many, if not most of us, are challenged far more with choices that are gray in nature than we are with choices that are black and white. We're daily choosing between the lesser of two evils or the greater of two goods. But we hear very little about the exercise of free agency in this context and receive little encouragement to think for ourselves to gain personal revelation for dealing with those gray issues of life. And now my favorite, the correlation department. It has been said that with the exception of the American Revolution, every revolution which started out positively eventually went too far. For example, the French Revolution and the Communist Revolution. Likewise, the development of the correlation department, which within the church was not unlike a revolution to many, was not necessarily a bad idea initially in 1961 and has accomplished some good. But like other revolutions, it in many respects has gone too far. The influence of the correlation departments is pervasive throughout the church. By its very nature, contributes greatly to the perceptions of overt control by the church. It's a funnel through which virtually all material must pass for approval. Individual thought and discovery are discouraged, and teachers are admonished to follow the manual far more than they're encouraged to seek inspiration. Let me skip a little bit. But there's much more troublesome issue relative to correlation. It's no secret that conformity is the ultimate goal of correlation. And while conformity to broad black and white commandments is appropriate, it appears that conformity to a particular view of all sorts of gray issues is also the goal of correlation. That, in fact, many of the gray issues of life that were discussed earlier are increasingly being redefined as black and white issues, particularly by our lesson manuals. Whether we like it or not, the materials in our manuals is taken to be gospel by the majority. And that particular view of those gray issues emanates from a precious few people who are not prophets or apostles. All this, of course, flies in the face of the scripture in the Doctrine and Covenants, where it states, "It is not meet that I should command in all things." Skip down a little bit. Joseph Smith said that we teach correct principles and the people govern themselves. It requires an avarice exercise in free agency to discern where the teaching of principles ends or should end and where the governing of self begins. Some would say that we've traded inspired thought for correlated thought. Somehow, the church has survived through correlation without correlation for many years. Surely the church would continue to survive and perhaps thrive more if the scope and power of the correlation department were more limited, brought more in line with the principle of free agency. Now a word about guilt. Rhetoric over the pulpit and in lesson manuals, etc., that is less controlling may also help minimize the judgmental, guilt-imposing tendencies that we all have to criticize people who are not following the program in the same way that we have, that we do. In answer to that tendency, J. Reuben Clark said, "We must give up the idea too many of us have that our way of life and living is not only the best, but often the only true way of life and living in the world, that we know what everybody else in the world should do and how they should do it. If God intended for us all to be the same, he surely missed the boat. Each and every individual in creation is so strikingly unique. Surely individuality is important to our Father in heaven." Let me skip down a little more. "But we are so good at imposing guilt on each other, and we're so good at accepting and internalizing guilt feelings, and our lesson manuals are so good at spurring it all on. I've heard someone ask if there is any room in the church for the individual anymore, and one pondered, and one friend pondered, can we each respond differently to the intricacies of life and each still find place in heaven?" Let me skip to the conclusion now. I would summarize these issues discussed in this paper as follows. One, we have a perception problem in that many people perceive the church to be a cult. Two, most people equate the word cult with mind control, which means that many people believe the church is associated with mind control. Three, that perception is detrimental to the first component of our threefold mission of the church to proclaim the gospel. Four, that perception is inconsistent with our doctrines of free agency. And five, there are organizational and rhetorical conditions that lend credence to both internal and external perceptions of mind control on the part of the church. Six, assuming that there is any credence to the above perceptions, we must also assume that some of our organizational structures and rhetorical patterns are inconsistent with our own doctrines of free agency. And seven, it would require far more than just window dressings from public communications department in order to correct these internal and external perception problems. And let me briefly illustrate that last point with an example from the advertising industry. As we all know, the Ford Corporation had a perception problem that they made cheap cars lacking in any quality. The advertising department mounted a rather aggressive campaign to change that perception, and they adopted the slogan, "With Ford, the quality is job one." They measured perceptions before, during, and after that campaign, and though that they didn't eradicate the perception problem, they did find that overall the perceptions of the product improved dramatically, as did the sales. However, as much as that advertising manager would like to have taken full credit for that result, even he had to strenuously emphasize that the key success was the fact that they could validate their claims, that in fact there were broad and sweeping changes in the organization that resulted in the actuality of improved quality, which gave credibility to their claims. Now, in church public relations, we don't usually mount those kinds of aggressive advertising campaigns, but we do create opportunities for publicity, at which time we're asked some rather difficult questions about our negative perceptions. Granted, where the cult issue is concerned, we have a great story to tell relative to our doctrines of free agency. But insofar as our perceived actions do not match our words, we lack credibility. And finally, it is the gospel that is true and relatively unchanging. The church consists of an imperfect organization and imperfect people striving to become perfect, which is to say, striving to come more in line with the gospel. And if free agency and the plan of salvation is, as Neil Maxwell suggests, the wrong thing to be wrong about, then I submit that the time has come for the church organization and its people to take a careful look at this issue of control and blind obedience in an effort to come more in line with the gospel principle of free agency.
This is a situation where I have learned quite a bit about collaborative writing. We were asked to respond together, and I get the feeling that the end result may be the kind of cow designed by a committee. I hope that we can what we have done together, Helen and I have greatly appreciated the opportunity to have a joint response to this very stimulating paper. We've spent a couple of trips to and from Logan arguing vigorously about what was said and what should have been said and what our responses should be. We finally flipped a coin to decide who should serve as spokesman. I'm not sure who won. I do know that last night she went to bed while I had to stay up formulating some of our reactions. Basically, we feel that this is a very good paper and one that raises a number of questions that are very profitably to be discussed, things that we are truly grateful for having the stimulus to stimulate our own thinking. I think, though, that at the outset I should say that we really see that there are two different papers here. And I would love to encourage Lou to write up both and get some broader responses. We had an opportunity on Wednesday when we were coming down to the symposium to bring some family members who had been here for a visit and were returning to the East. And my brother-in-law, who is not a member of the church, when he heard what we were going to be talking about, said that he had had a discussion with a number of co-workers before they left. They found out that he was coming to Utah, and they said, "Oh, you're going to be among the Mormons." And the first perception that they talked about was the question, is this a cult? Are the Mormons a cult? And they discussed this without doing the library research. They came up with a different definition. They looked at a number of dictionaries. They finally ended up deciding that an organization is not a cult if it's been around long enough and has enough people and enough clout. If it's expensive, if it's powerful and wealthy, it's not a cult. I'm not sure how they resolved the question for themselves. But this is a common perception. But the two questions that I think we really need to deal with in the presentation that Lou has given us can be broken down as two questions. First of all, what is it about Mormonism that allows people to classify us with the Rajneeshis, the Moonies, the Jim Jones people? Are there things that really justify the widespread, we hope, misperception? And this gets at the list of descriptors. It also raises the question that she has said it's not the reality that is important for perceptions, for people's dealings with the church, as it is their perceptions. The second question that I think we need to look at is the one that was given immortal expression by Rhett Butler. "Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn." Should we give a damn? Should we care how people perceive us? For much of the history of the church, I think there's no question that the missionaries, the leaders of the church, have taken pride in the fact that we are a peculiar people. We are distinctive. There are things that make us different that perhaps give us our greatest appeal. And if that is the case, why should we care about what people think? And I think that Lou has responded to this in a very significant way. I think we have to care because people who perceive things too wrongly close their ears. They're not willing to listen. The missionaries have no opportunity to speak to them. I think, however, that the question of whether or not we are called is only one of a number of misperceptions, many of which we can't do anything about. For example, in the paper she mentioned that the one of the other perceptions is the same thing that came up in my brother-in-law's discussion. Is the are Mormons Christians? Now, we believe and teach Our doctrine has always been Christ-centered. There is nothing more important to us than the mission of Christ and our attempt to follow him. And yet, the perception, no matter what, is that we are not Christians. We are perceived as a cult or as non-Christian, or even worse, as a non-Christian cult. And this tends to be this turns people off. It's the same kind of thing that missionaries run into when they walk down the street two by two, and the people who have been looking out the doors, say, or peeking through the curtains, shut the door, don't answer the door, because these are the Jehovah's Witnesses. The JWs are the ones that go two by two. And it's a tremendously frustrating thing, as I can tell by experience, to be confused with these people who have nothing to do with our mission. But these misperceptions interfere with missionary work. So there's no question that we should do something that to correct misperceptions when we can. I think I'm not sure that dealing with questions of our own rhetoric, our own emphases internally, is the way to get at the misperceptions that people outside the church have. I wonder if every speaker at General Conference in October were to address the themes of free agency, our responsibility to have our own opinions, to investigate, to explore, to deal with questions of free agency and the plan of salvation. If every talk in conference were to focus exclusively on the concerns that Lou has raised, would her friend Bob find out? Would it change his perception? Would the perceptions of the co-workers of my brother-in-law change? Would they know? Would they care? Would they hear the missionaries any better? This is one of the things that that I think we have to deal with. The misperceptions abound. The press that has been given to polygamous splinter groups, the press that has been generated by the Mormon governor to the south, who is no longer the Mormon governor to the south. These things have to do with the perceptions that people have, and they some of them we can't do anything about. And where we can't do anything about them, then we have to shrug our shoulders and say, our job is to teach the truth, and when we can teach people, if we can get to people and say, this is the way it is, then we can allow them to make their own decisions. And this is what we would like to do. The other paper that we see in Lou's presentation is, I think, marvelous, and one that we seriously need to deal with. And I hope that this will be explored further. This is the question of what is it within the church that makes our own perceptions do this. This is how our misperceptions within the church, our folklore, our misunderstanding of ourselves. How does this affect the way we function in the church? Need we be concerned in the church with issues of free agency versus mind control? Is the counsel that we must follow the brethren a detriment to our own free agency? Are we constrained to accept the decisions of our leaders blindly? Is guilt used to stifle doubt? I think I'm afraid that all of us have experienced this kind of thing, where the well-meaning, well-intentioned lay leaders in the church, or segments of ward populations who feel strongly about one thing, can make it very difficult to have faithful discussions or faithful doubt. This is a serious concern. I wonder whether in the larger issues of the perceptions outside the church, whether we are different enough. We had a discussion a couple of nights ago with Armand Moss about sociological situations in the church, and he says that for the last few years, the greatest area of growth within the church has been in the Southeast, the Bible Belt. When I was a missionary in the Southeast, our concern was to let people know how different we were. We wanted to distance ourselves from the other churches. Now, it may be that we are perceived as so much like them that this is where we find a receptive ear, that we are attracting moral majoritarians. The Southern Baptists are worried about the inroads the Mormons are making into their congregations. I wonder why. I wonder if it is a question of perception and whether we ought to give a damn, whether this is something that is a legitimate area of concern for us. What is it that sets us apart? Are we as different as people sometimes think? We believe in theology. We used to start out with delineating the difference between the Mormon position about the Godhead and the common attitude of the churches. The other churches have come around. They're willing to accept anything we say. We believe in tithing. So do they. You heard the TV evangelists? Give till it hurts. 10% is only the beginning. We're not peculiar. We believe in the word of wisdom. This is how many people now, the anti-smoking campaign has had a tremendous impact. We are not perceived as different as we were one time. Well, I want to leave a little bit of time to allow you to ask questions of Lou particularly. We think that these questions she raises are worth discussion. We need to think about them. We need to talk about them. We need to decide how they affect our perceptions for members of the church and for people outside of the church. I'm not sure that those two different perceptions are things that we can get at by the same actions, but both of them need to be addressed. So we thank you, Lou, for our chance to respond to your thing. We thank you.
We have a few minutes now for questions, so if anybody would like to address them to specifically someone, okay?
No. I don't work for the church. I work for a corporation. My calling in the church is regional public communications director, that gives me a lot of authority to work real hard. That's about it. I've shared my paper with my friends in the public communications department in Salt Lake. But no, as I said in the paper, the cult issue is, in my region, is in the top three. The top problem in Pennsylvania is obscurity, and they just don't know we're there. And so at this point, we're just working to get inroads. Now, when we are invited to be on talk show type things, if the moderator has done their homework and they know a little bit about these perception issues, then we have a hard time. If they haven't done their homework, then we have a great story to tell with the plan of salvation and free agency relative to this issue.
I think something that is obvious but maybe should be mentioned is this is a question of perceptions within the states, probably. This is not a worldwide consideration in Lou's paper. I don't know what the cult perception of Mormonism would be on a world level. And I think Larry's response, implicit in his response, was that this is stateside consideration.
Well, your first part, I think if I were asked to be on a talk show and respond to the issue of cult, I would say essentially what you said. The point is that the perceptions exist. I mean, I certainly don't want to say that I'm saying the church is a cult. I don't think it is. What I'm saying is that these are the descriptors that I found in the literature that exists in libraries everywhere, and that we are listed as a cult, and we have to be able to respond in a positive way.
Right. And I did not respond very well to the second half of your comment. And to that, I would say, relative to the Christianity issue, it's true that we are separate from, our doctrines are very different than most Christian churches. However, from a public relations standpoint, if the perception exists that we are not a Christian church, that tells, and if I don't know anything about Mormonism, and I hear, oh, Mormons aren't Christians, that tells me, oh, Mormons don't care about Christ. And I care about Christ, so I don't want to have anything to do with that religion. So it is a public relations and missionary problem if that perception exists. I mean, it's true, and we get into definition kinds of things, but it's a perception problem. We have to understand that people out there in the world outside of Utah do not know anything about the church. Anything.
Our time is up, and thank you very much.